Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Culloden.
Brought to you by PwC.
This is News Talk.
Well, hello everyone and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Culloden and this is a show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. Coming up on today's show, are we about to see a once in a 50-year change in the US stock market calendar? Is Gen Z giving up on property altogether? Plus, are you living in a 15-minute city? You can email the show takingstock@newstalk.com or you can message me on socials at Susan Hayes Culloden and I'm on LinkedIn, I'm on Facebook, I'm on everything along the way. I'm going to start off today by explaining to you the term the dot plot. All week long, the world was watching to see if Jay Powell would cut interest rates in the US by 0.25%, and he did that on Thursday, as expected. However, the dot plot shows how each Fed member projects future interest rates. Now, the Fed members, of course, will likely shift their projections as new economic data rolls in, so it's not entirely predictive. But the reason I'm bringing it up is because it's really unusual to see just how disparate their views are at the moment. So, for example, one member thinks the Fed should raise rates 0.25% before the year end. Six members think the Fed should hold them steady, and it just shows how hard it is to call what's going on in the US. And this will have a ripple effect here on our prices, our savings, our exports and more. So check out the dot plot in the quarters to come. Now, this week we heard an idea was mooted that could change something about the American publicly listed business calendar that has been held dear for the past 55 years. President Trump's proposal to stop quarterly financial reporting by US companies has plenty of voices who back the idea and lots that don't. But what will ultimately happen? I'm delighted that Russ Mould from AJ Bell joins me now to discuss the idea. And Russ, I find quarterly company meetings earnings, they're the most intriguing way to find out what's really going on in business and in microeconomics. So to get us started today, can you tell us what the obligations are on US companies quoted in the stock market and why should we care?
Yeah, it goes back to rules introduced by the Securities and Exchange Commission, the main American regulator in the 1930s. And as you say, since 1970, American companies have been required to report a full set of accounts, profit and loss account, balance sheet, and cash flow, and file it with the regulator every 3 months. So if the quarter end, if the year end is December, they have quarter ends in March, June, September, December, and then within about 4 to 6 weeks of that period end, they will come up with all of these numbers. And then as a result, they'll also probably have a conference call with the management team, put out some extra information in the slides, and maybe even as well, though they're not obliged to, give an outlook statement for the next 3 months as well.
And Ross, in addition though, this isn't just for a closed group of people. I mean, this is for anybody who wants to join, typically can. Anybody certainly who wants the transcript can look at it. And also analysts can ask questions then to the management team on everything you've said there, the profit and loss, the balance sheet, their prepared remarks, everything. So is there a public service, you could say, in one way for these earnings calls?
The transparency that it provides is fantastic. And also, as you say, it means that the idea is that everybody has the same information at the same time. The numbers are normally released, as they said, before the bell or after the bell. So before the US stock market opens, normally at around, you know, early in the morning in the US, it tends to work out about 1 o'clock UK time, 1 o'clock over here. And then either after the bell, 9 p.m. UK time. So very set times, very public. All the dates are always trailered well in advance. Everybody knows when it's happening on the day, the time. The conference call set is always set. And if you miss it, there's always, as you say, the transcript or a recording to listen to on the company investor relations website. So the object is transparency, and it achieves that. Now, you can argue that companies have got quite cute at presenting the numbers in a favorable way. And, you know, management teams will do their best to persuade you that everything is wonderful, but you can still look at the numbers yourself and the trends in the numbers and pick them apart to see whether the management team are giving as accurate a representation as they could be.
Well, as you say, the objective is transparency, and particularly for people who are interested in investing in the stock or who are invested in it. But I have an ulterior motive, Ross, I have to admit. I think they are the most intriguing business education. When you want to see like what companies are doing with AI or how they're handling tariffs or what the challenges are or where they're placing their big bets or what they're investing in, like it's absolutely red hot, finger on the pulse stuff when it comes to business education. What do you get out of them?
I get out of them a sense of what management is thinking, mm-hmm. what's changing in its business and indeed and its financial strength. And if you look at any company, When you buy one share in it or you own all of the shares, you're investing in the competitive position of the business. Why do its customers come to it for a service or a product, and why are they prepared to pay for it, something that they could maybe get somewhere else? You're looking at, you're getting a feel for the management acumen because you're buying into that. Are they good at what they're doing? Are their interests aligned with yours? Are they thinking in terms of not just their interests, but those of the company, the stakeholders, and the staff and the shareholders? And you get a view on its financial strength, its balance sheet. So you get a very, very 3D rounded picture of the company, its strategy, how that turns into financial performance, and how that comes from operational performance. And once you've got a fair view of that, you can make a decision as to whether you think the company is well run, has a strong position, and after that you can decide whether you think the shares represent decent value or not. So it's a vital part of investing in any business for the long term. Now, you can get dragged into short-term decisions, and companies are very, very good at setting up estimates so that they can beat them and provide the beat and get a pop in their share price on the day, but it still helps you form a long-term view of the company because that's really what you're after.
And a clarion call to any business owner or business leader listening to us today. If you're wondering what are the really big players doing in your industry, go on to the earnings call of the company who is interested, or the earnings call of the company that is the really big player in your industry, and you will get a really good sense of it for sure. But to move on to the task at hand here now, Russ. So President Trump says, look, putting forward where you stand every 65 working days, because that's what a quarter is prioritizing short-termism over longer-term strategy. Jamie Dimon and Warren Buffett had an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal in June 2018, putting this forward. But what do you think? Do you think earnings calls and having to present to the world every 3 months, and as you say, around the time of the bell, is that prioritizing short-termism?
I think there is a legitimate danger of that, but companies are very, very good at dealing with this. I mean, if we just look at the last quarter, and I'm indebted to Standard & Poor's here, and Howard Silverblatt provides a big spreadsheet that's free to access every day, and he summarizes the quarterly results. So if you look at the S&P 500, 500 biggest companies in America, for the last quarter, 496 have already reported, 77% beat expectations and only 17% missed. So companies are pretty good at running themselves to A, get this data out in a timely, clear fashion, and B, they're pretty good at setting expectations that give them a fair old chance of jumping over the bar that they set, barring unexpected events. So they're incredibly set up for it. They're well run for it. So I think in that respect, you're looking for potentially for a solution to a problem that doesn't exist. The American stock market is at an all-time high, let's not forget. Secondly, UK companies, we actually only get, for example, first half and second half results here. But even those that don't report quarterly provide regular updates in the middle. So I'm not sure it makes that much of a difference. And company failures are rare. I mean, that's why they're such big headline. Things like in the UK, Patisserie Valerie or Conviviality or Lehman Brothers in America. Failures make news because they're rare. And it is actually pretty hard to cut the numbers. That said, you know, J.K. Galbraith, the economist, did refer to the concept of the bezel, where companies start to get cute with their numbers, particularly during bull runs when everybody's relaxed, everybody's making money, nobody wants to rock the boat. And so you when you do get company failures, or you do get failures of corporate governance, it tends to be when things are going well, which, let's face it, they are right now, because the stock market is pretty much at an all-time high. So if you are going to get what Galbraith called the bezel, it's going to be around now. So the danger is if transparency is reduced, you're sowing the seeds for the next corporate scandal or next major failure. And the people who will suffer the most are the private investors, the individual, because they won't have access to the sort of data that the hedge funds or the big fund management companies have got.
You're bringing up a term there that I need to explore more, which is corporate governance. Because as you said, one of the objectives of these is transparency. If you have to report every single 3 months to the world in a very public fashion, it does allow for people to get a better sense of what's going on. However, where the challenge arises here, based on the three people that I mentioned, and I don't always have Jamie Dimon, Warren Buffett and President Trump all in the same sentence, but the whole point here is that does this allow room for strategic thinking? Now, I could go back through the 90s, through the 2000s, through the last decade, and I could refer to corporate governance scandals that I don't think I would put in the same sentence as a lack of strategic planning. So do you feel that the lower transparency And the trade-off one might get in lower corporate governance would be offset by an increase in the quality of strategic and long-term thinking.
That's the argument. The president's saying that there'll be more long-term planning, there's less time wasted on all of this stuff, and in the end he wants to there is a bigger picture here, which is the president wants to deregulate. He's already chastising the Bureau for Labor Statistics for publishing what he views are unhelpful numbers, inaccurate numbers, so he sacked the head of that. He's looking to deregulate in other areas and make it easy for some companies to list. He's making it easy for companies to sweep things like cyber attacks under the carpet. He wants to run the American economy hot. Less regulation, lower interest rates, lower dollar, lower oil prices, lower personal taxes. So I understand the concept of that, but there are risks inherent in that as well. And I don't think there has been a major lack of strategic planning. Because if you look at the US S&P 500, look at how many American firms are held up as not just American leaders, but world leaders. You know, the names trip off the tongue. And AI would be a classic example of that. So I don't think there has been a shortage of strategic planning, genuinely known. I think that's why American companies have share price have done well, valuations done well, and the stock market has done well to the benefit of American savers. Because of this transparency, because of this regulation, American companies are trusted. They probably get a bit of a lower cost of capital. They probably give even more access to capital than other firms. And that has enabled them to spend that money, invest that money and grow.
Well, there is also another point going on here. You're right about the aim to deregulate, but I was listening to Scott Bessent talking about this as well during the week. And he also makes the point that if the US stock market, like the actual service of the stock market, also is a place that isn't just deep and isn't just liquid, but also is a place where companies can potentially cut costs by not reporting in a greater way, that it might be a more attractive place yet again to list your company. And if I could just park that point temporarily for a moment, I think what's underlying this is it attractive to list at all? Like looking back, Ross, the US has had over 7,000 publicly listed companies in the mid-90s, and that has fallen to around 4,000 by 2020. I mean, is this because of the rise of private equity money? Is this because the scrutiny is too hard? Is it because companies don't have to? They don't need to raise money necessarily? What do you think is driving the actual decline in the popularity of listing at all that might need Scott Bessent's point about attractiveness in order to give that a resurgence?
I understand the argument about the regulatory burden. And when I started doing this job 34 years ago, BP, the oil company that's quoted here in London and also has a quote in New York, its annual report and accounts was about 50 or 60 pages long. It's now 300, 400, 500. So you could argue that, you know, some of that is regulatory requirements. Some of it is the company wanting to genuinely say, look, we're doing a really good job. And some of it is probably a bit of a nuisance for everybody. And in some ways, in a worst case, it could actually be a way for the company to hide the really nasty stuff because it takes an awful lot of wading through. So there are cases for and against there. But I don't think that's the key issue. I think it may be a contributory factor, but I think the biggest contributory factor to the decline in the number of publicly listed companies is the fact that debt has just become progressively cheaper. Mm-hmm. Equity is undeniably expensive. You have shareholders who do keep you on your toes, who do occasionally demand dividends. So there's no doubt it can be a more expensive way of funding you, but only if debt cost. But debt's cost has collapsed to zero for most of the 2010s, when many of those companies have disappeared. So they've been able to fund themselves cheaply with debt, or private equity companies have been able to take them over, funding themselves cheaply with debt. Now that we've seen interest rates go up from zero to something, I think that may be something that managers will have to consider and may make equity relatively more attractive. Though, let's face it, it does look as if interest rates have peaked and are already going back down again, nowhere near the peaks that they reached, say, in the 1980s. But I think debt and the affordability of it and the availability of it is probably a bigger factor than that, than regulation.
And thus the cost as well. I mean, that's the point here, is that I think the way in which this argument is being presented about attracting people is it needs a fundamental reshift when it comes to that point. But you mentioned there what the last earnings season has held. Like, to a large degree, there's been a lot of beats. And for anybody who's unfamiliar with that term, that means that the estimates that companies were putting forward, particularly for their profits or for their earnings, they have beaten them in the past quarter. And a couple of things that stand out to me, Ross, over the past quarter has been AI. Of course, the AI theme has dominated. Seems, particularly in Europe, we've passed peak uncertainty about US-Europe relations as regards, like, is it going to be 200% tariffs or 15 type thing? We've seen interest rates stay higher for longer, possibly as well in the US than expected. We see tariffs hurting retail companies, like we've seen that in Lululemon, in their earnings and obviously their respective share price in Walmart, in Hermes. And also the Mag 7's performance hasn't actually truly raced past the index insofar as it has since the beginning, it has caught up, we could say, in the overall year to date, as distinct to what it's just been like after the 8th of April. That has been a couple of the things that I've spotted over the past quarter. What have been the highlights for you of earnings season this time?
I mean, in the US, again, to use Standard & Poor's numbers, earnings were up 11% year on year in the second quarter. That supports analyst consensus forecast of 11% growth for the whole year to a new all-time high. And you could argue it maybe provides some support to their estimates of a 17% growth rate in 2026 to another all-time high. If you're looking for the areas that surprised on the upside, it was IT, which goes back to your point about AI, Susan. Healthcare was another area, and industrials actually did pretty well. The areas where you saw weakness or the bulk of the negative surprises were materials, where, let's face it, running a mine can be a pretty tricky business, and the weather, geology, and all sorts of different things can go wrong, and commodity prices can be very volatile. Real estate, where there's the ongoing battle with do people go back to the office, online assault on retail, and consumer staples and consumer discretionary, where you may be seeing some impact of tariffs and persuading customers to change their purchasing patterns. So nothing terribly surprising there. I think the one thing that we have to be aware of is that earnings are at an all-time high, and this estimate of another big leap in 2026, on the face of it, looks quite aggressive when corporate margins are already at lofty levels, profits are already at record highs. A lot of it's AI related. If those numbers don't come through, then US equities will look expensive, but that's an argument that we've heard before and it hasn't worked yet. But eventually, you know, the handicapper will stop a racehorse, weight will stop a train, and if estimates don't, you know, valuation will eventually slow a stock market down, especially if the earnings don't come through.
Well, we're at the beginning of a whole new earnings season and a whole new adventure. Thank you so much indeed, Russ Mole from AJ Bell, for taking the time to talk to us today on Taking Stock. This is Susan A's Cullerton here on News Talk, and coming up after the break is Gen Z swapping bricks and mortar for stocks and shares. Now you're very welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton. Now for our economic trivia section. First up, I want to give a shout out to Emer O'Regan and Pat Brennan, who both sent me in the correct answer to my trivia questions last week about credit unions. And this week I was in Dublin's most sustainable building. That is my first question to you today. What is Dublin's most sustainable building today? And my second question got me thinking about all things sustainability, and here it is. What percentage of Ireland's total electricity was generated by wind power in 2024? Please do send me in an email, takingstock@newstalk.com, if you have the answer. And I will also give you the answer later on in the show. Now, with the housing market increasingly out of reach for younger generations, many Gen Z investors are turning to stocks, ETFs, also called exchange-traded funds, and even alternative assets as their preferred path to building wealth. And this marks a clear shift away from the traditional view of property as the ultimate investment. To explore these generational differences in how we save, invest and plan for the future, I'm joined now by consumer and personal finance expert and presenter of The Home Show here in News Talk, Sinead Ryan. Sinead, this week we saw Revolut publishing findings of a survey that it has conducted itself. And it says, although 29% of Irish people aged 13 to 28 said they had an interest in property, a much higher 37% said stocks and ETFs were their top choice. Why do you think this might be?
Hi, Susan. I think it's fairly clear why it is. The barriers to entry to the property market are extraordinary. I mean, property's always been expensive, but the barriers are so high now. You need a really hefty deposit. The price keeps going up, so you're price chasing even from the moment you get that deposit together. The macroprudential rules mean that there is a maximum that you can borrow, and house prices are going up all the time. So there's a huge cohort of people who just genuinely believe this is not going to be for them. It's never going to happen. And they're happy if they have money spare to use it elsewhere, to invest it elsewhere and try and get a return where they can.
And therefore, is the stock market and potentially cryptocurrency, is it that Gen Z are looking for something where they can immediately sell it? Is it liquidity, Sinead?
Do you know what? I think it is mostly to do with confidence and accessibility. And you know, it's a generational thing. These are people who have always lived their lives digitally. So they have expectations on how to access any services. I mean, we see it when they want to access government services or banking services. And it's no different when it comes to investments. They don't want to sit opposite a stuffy old stockbroker and pay them a fee and listen to their advice and for it to take ages to buy and sell and trade, when they can do two taps and get that kick, if that's what they want, or a real return if that's what they're looking for. So the accessibility to funds and to investments and equities in particular, along with alternative investments like crypto, has never been easier. Mm-hmm. It's very, very simple to do. It's also very cheap to do. And they are things that absolutely appeal to this particular age group, this Gen Z cohort.
So it is familiarity with the device, with the way in which they do other things, as you say, two taps and they're into the investment that they want. One thing I was delighted to see, Sinead, is that the findings revealed Ireland has the second highest proportion of women investors in the Gen Z age group across Europe, with more than 35% of the people who are investing in and through Revolut being women. Sinead, you and I are often found to be talking about women and investing, or women and pensions, women and finance, etc. Are the women of Ireland gaining momentum?
I think it's great to see. We know, Susan, and you would know this as well, that financial literacy in Ireland and indeed across Europe is absolutely abysmal. And I'm sorry to say it is even worse when it comes to women. And anything that will allow that financial conversation to take place, research into products, into taxation, into the movement of money, would be absolutely welcomed. Now, the only concern would be that in so doing, that there is an entry into this market. It's very simple to do. It's very easy to do. It's very cheap to do. But that leaves you open then to all sorts of problems down the line. One is, well, all my friends are doing it, therefore I should be doing it. The other is that you leave yourself open to be scammed, and also leave yourself open to become a money mule. And this is where, you know, ne'er-do-wells will look for information on your account, rest money in it, and you get, you know, a kind of a shaving off that. It's happening in schools, girls as well as boys. It's a really, really worrying development. If we know, and we don't know from this research, but if it is the case that women and girls are sitting down and researching and reading and focusing on the pluses and the minuses and the pros and the cons before making their choices, well, that is absolutely to be welcomed. It's a fantastic kind of progress, but it would be a big departure from what we actually know is happening, which is, you know, in some cases, it's a get rich quick thing. It's like, look, everybody else is in crypto. I'm just going to buy up loads of Bitcoin and see what happens. And you will have to worry down the line if there is a bubbles that burst, if things don't fall through.
I do just want to ask you about this too, though, is you say there's a big problem with financial literacy. Okay, is there the space then for this to be filled by regulation, by education, by culture? Like, what's the answer to this? I mean, you've written a book about financial literacy. I've written a book about financial literacy. We can talk about it an awful lot on platforms like this, but what is the silver bullet to make this right?
Certainly regulation has a part to play. It's getting better, Susan. I mean, for instance, in the mainstream market, which is unit trusts, life insurance products, pensions, there's a lot more transparency than used to be the case. Now you're told how much is taken in fees and charges, how much your broker is getting. I'm not sure everybody reads all that stuff because it can run to pages and pages and pages, but it's there. With the online stuff, it's not always that clear. And sometimes people find out the hard way because they lose money on an investment. And then they have to go in the back end and say, what happened? Why was that money taken off? What was it for? So education plays a big part. Regulation definitely has a part to play. The EU does do a good job here, but there's lots more that could be done by banks, by these platforms that allow this trading to happen. And you know, we have to open up the conversation. It's good that people are getting involved in their money and in decisions about their money. It's much better to be active than passive. But hopefully that comes with a responsibility to go looking for the accurate information.
Yeah, the accurate bit there, of course, is the key point. Sinead, if I look again at the generations, though, can I ask, how do you think the environment or the starting point for young people today is different to their parents and grandparents? Like, when I talk to my mom and dad about things like this, they would say they had much higher interest rates in the time that they were buying their house versus, let's say, when myself and my husband were buying ours. What do you think differentiates the generations?
Well, in terms of house prices, the big one is multiple of income. So housing and property has always been expensive. No question. I mean, you can hear your parents or grandparents who bought, oh, I paid 5,000 euros or pounds for my house back in whenever. But like as a multiple of income, it was probably around 4 to 5 times. Now it is 10 to 12 easily. And that's the big differentiation. That's the change in it. It's not that it hasn't always been expensive. It's not that interest rates haven't always been high. They go through cycles, of course. It's that multiple of income. It's so difficult to do it based on the income that you can afford to borrow and that you ought to be able to borrow. I don't see anything wrong with the macroprudential rules that central bank have laid down. I mean, 4 times income, 4.5 times income, that's pretty much as it should be. But that does not put you in the market. And that is the problem. So it is the rampant increase in house price inflation, which hasn't kept up with wages. It's gone flying ahead of it. That is the single biggest issue that is keeping people out of the market.
Okay. Well, if we just look at the positive side of Gen Z as well and the opportunities that are awaiting them from an investing point of view, I'm just going to read you out a quote from the head of wealth and trading at Revolut, who said they, and she was referring to Gen Z, they simply cannot rely on buying a home to start building towards their financial future. So they're starting earlier, investing smaller amounts and using tools that were once the preserve of professional investors. So apart from not being able to rely on buying a home, everything else there seems like a good development to me, Sinead. What do you think?
Again, with all the information that you have, yes, it is. I think it's fantastic to see Gen Z embracing fintech, embracing different forms of investment. I've written about whiskey investments, luxury good investments. Gold is at an all-time high. Now, they aren't just old fogies and professional investors. They are people who are hedging. They understand diversification or portfolio. They know the difference between a gilt and an equity. That is fantastic where that is the case. And property is no longer, I mean, property is a very Irish thing as well. It was always that preserve. If you have bricks and mortar, you can't go wrong. Well, I mean, we found out you could go wrong and you could go wrong in a very disastrous way. So, if you have a generation of people who feel locked out of that market, well, of course, it's not that they don't have money. They're going to invest it in a different way. And for a lot of them, they'll make money. And for some of them, they lose money. And therein lies the vagaries of investing in the stock market. But it can happen with property. We know it. We've seen it. So I think if you have a generation who are just willing to rent and they're just willing to say, do you know what? I'm okay to do this for as long as I have to and I'll make my money elsewhere. Well, good on them.
Okay. And I just to extend that thought a little bit further, what do you think the appeal is of cryptocurrency? I find when I'm talking to young people about it, they're excited by it. They love the volatility of it. They don't understand it necessarily, but they don't feel that they need to. I could be generalizing here, but it's from many, many, many conversations over the past couple of years. What do you think the appeal is?
Well, I used the word confidence before, but in fact, to some extent, there's a little bit of bravado. And I think this is an age group that is more than happy to take a chance, more than happy to take a risk. They're more likely to be swayed by friends, by peer groups, by stuff they read online. Now, that's not to say they can't navigate through the wheat and the chaff. Some of them will get scammed, let's face it. But even where they're not, they are more willing to take that chance. Now, I'm not of that generation. I want to be very cautious. I have a very modest outlook on the returns that I want and expect from any form of investment. But if I was 25, would I feel different? I might. And if it's disposable income, if it's something they're saying, do you know what, I'm never going to get a mortgage here, I might as well take this 10 or 15,000 euros I've saved up for something on the never-never that's not going to happen, and I'm going to put it in this or that. The ease of access is there. It takes 2 minutes to set up an account and away you go.
That bravado. Interesting that's the term that's coming up here. I looked around the world for instances of where financial literacy has done well. And actually, one of the places that I found was Nigeria, because they have a platform that's like Revolut, but it's not Revolut, that gamifies money in ways. And it teaches, particularly, again, young people, younger now than the people in the survey here. And I was just thinking about the role Revolut plays in teaching people how to use money well. So it is, like, Revolut is the most successful of the handful of European fintechs founded in the past decade. It has more than 55 million customers, including 3 million in Ireland. And it has gamification tools, it has rev points, it has cool spending insights. Do you think Revolut takes seriously the role it has in financial education? Or do you think young people simply see it as a way of transferring money from one person to another?
Well, it's certainly been very clever in branding and marketing, no question. It's highly successful. Now, I have spoken to people over the years that have not always been able to do what they hoped to do with Revolut. In other words, people who thought they were setting up a savings account or like a vault, and what they ended up with was an investment account. Now, Susan, they are two entirely different things. Mm-hmm. A savings account is a deposit. You're not going to lose any money. It's guaranteed by the European Central Bank. An investment account is a totally different thing. There are no guarantees. You can lose all your money and you have to be super careful. So I think there's probably an education piece that can be done. You know, people scroll down these things, you know, accept. You know, when you're scrolling through loads and loads of data, do you accept our terms and conditions? And people are in such a rush to get into the thing. They go yeah. And in fact, maybe a warning, maybe a pop-up saying, this is not a guaranteed vehicle, you may lose your money. And that kind of stuff, we see it with mainstream banks. It's very important to have it on financial products. It's mandatory on insurance products. So it would be great to see that and more of that being front and center. In other words, you have to acknowledge you've read it. You have to acknowledge you've understood that, because that would stop you maybe making the wrong decision or giving you that time just to step back and decide, oh, hang on a second, that's not what I thought. It's not that maybe people won't always do it, but it just gives you that protection from yourself, from that rush in.
And the last thing I want to ask you about, Sinead, is in a similar vein, when you talk about rushing in, financial services, the business itself is often generated from commission or seemingly very small percentages, and they are small percentages, but on maybe a lot of transactions or on a significant amount of money. So what do you think needs to be done to make fee structures more transparent when it comes to investing at any age, Gen Z or otherwise?
Everything needs to be done.
We have
some structures in place. As I say, there's been improvements in pension and insurance-based unit products. That's good to see. Now, I know if I go and visit a broker, and I get a financial health check and I'm asked about my risk profile and all that work is done, and it's valuable work and it should be paid for, sometimes I will get back a document. In fact, I know I will, which could be 30 or 40 pages in length. And it has all the warnings and all the caveats and everything that they've been told to do. The problem is that most ordinary people, their eyes glaze over with that stuff and they don't tend to read the fine print and the smaller print. I would love to see that front, center, big, different color, fonts, whatever it takes for people to understand. It's not that people mind spending the money, Susan. They don't. What they need to understand is this is coming out of the money that you're putting in. It doesn't wait until it makes a profit and then, you know, the company or the intermediary gets paid. They get paid first.
It's a very good point.
It takes a while to recover that and recoup it.
A great point to finish up on. Thank you very much indeed, consumer and personal finance expert and presenter of The Home Show here on News Talk, Sinead Ryan.
Thanks, Susan.
This is Susan A's Cullerton here on News Talk. And after the break, I ask, what can you get to within 15 minutes of where you live? Stay tuned. You're very welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Susan A's Cullerton. Now, I want to read out a message arising from the item that we did recently on what businesses in Ireland really want. Hubert Morris shared this comment on LinkedIn. He said, "We need a lot of things, Susan, but what we really need is emergency legislation to allow infrastructure development and the delivery of it. Leinster Outer Orbital has to be put back into the NDP." And of course, that is the National Development Plan. Also, Frank Gibbons sent in a message in response to the segment we did last week about AI in customer service. And he said, "Mandatory reading for all CEOs, management and staff should be Crowning the Customer by Fergal Quinn." So that's a good book recommendation there for all of us today. How would you feel about living in a city where everything you needed was a maximum of 15 minutes away? In fact, maybe you already do. So 2020 saw Anne Hidalgo elected mayor of Paris, promising to do just that. So where are we now with the idea of the 15-minute city? And has the idea evolved with the culture wars. I'm delighted to be joined now by Aitor Hernandez-Morales from Politico, who is based in Brussels and has been writing on the topic. So, first of all, Aitor, the concept of a 15-minute city is you get all your daily needs within a 15-minute walk, cycle or public transport. It's the idea of proximity urbanism. And really what that means is reconfiguring city blocks to prioritise people over cars. So what does this really mean in reality?
Well, in practice, what it actually means is essentially ensuring urban quality of life. So it's a concept that was basically squared away by this Franco-Colombian academic named Carlos Moreno, who ended up joining Anne Hidalgo's team in Paris. And the idea is essentially to revive neighborhoods and to go back in a lot of ways to how we lived before the 1950s, where, you know, most people got by either walking or with public transport or, you know, occasionally with a bicycle, but could rely on having their fundamental needs met in the places where they lived and therefore didn't, you know, need to grab their car to go to a shopping mall to be able to, you know, buy a gallon of milk. So it really does harken back to that. And the idea, again, is to make cities a bit more friendly to people and encourage community building through person-to-person interaction in a lot of ways.
Okay, and let's look around the world now, because obviously there you mentioned Paris and time-wise you've mentioned pre-1950s.
Yeah.
So where, if we just look in various different continents to see where this has been implemented, like Barcelona has created super blocks, and that meant pedestrianizing clusters of streets to create a sense of locality. Portland, mm-hmm. Seattle and Cleveland, all retrofitting car-centric suburbs to have more denser mixed-use urban villages. And even China, particularly Shanghai, but China's basic unit of neighborhood planning now focuses its guidelines around a 50-minute pedestrian catchment for 50,000 people. The real question here, though, is has this, in places like Barcelona or Portland or Cleveland or Shanghai, led to a better outcome for people?
So overall, what we hear from people in areas that are experimenting with this is actually really positive feedback. And one thing that should be taken into account is that, for example, in Barcelona, there was a lot of initial pushback against this super blocks format. And now even people who actually sued the city over it have backtracked. So you have this this really curious case there where in one particular street that was being affected, the merchants that had shops on the street sued the city. They won the case, and when the courts ordered the city to reverse the super blocks, the merchants came out and actually said, oh, please actually don't reverse it because we've seen our sales go up. So overall, it is a very positive thing, but you are right that the implementation tends to be rough because you're essentially asking people to reimagine the way that they live. None of us particularly like change when it involves, you know, changing the way that we carry out our day. And certainly if you own a car in a city, it can be pretty intimidating to find out you can no longer park that car on your street or drive up to your door. But in terms of the implementation, so what's curious is a lot of times when we talk about this idea, people think, oh, they're going to come in and they're going to ban cars in my city and it's going to be a very radical thing. And in truth, the implementation that we've seen around the world are much more piecemeal schemes, like what you just described with Portland's example or with Barcelona's example, where what they're doing is they're not banning cars, but they are carving out a larger swath of streets where cars can't go in and where people can reclaim them, where you can have green spaces, where you can have parks, where you can wander through the street and play on the street without having to worry about getting struck down.
Well, let's just pick up on the point about cars in particular, because Paris is seen as the poster child for this. And L'Institut, sorry, I'm really not pronouncing that very well, but L'Institut Paris Region, an urban planning agency, found that Parisians now use bicycles for 11.2% of their trips within the city centre. And that's nearly three times the rate of cars, which is 4.3%. But at the same time, Paris is the second most congested city in Europe after London, with drivers experiencing up to 97 hours of delays in a year. So, like, is this working then?
Well, it's a bit of a mixed bag. So the places where we see the scheme working best are actually older cities, simply because most of those cities weren't built for cars in the first place. So part of the success that you've seen with the uptick of cycling in Paris, which was something the city really encouraged during COVID, they laid out a lot of these cycle lanes that have since become permanent, is that people just realized it was actually faster to get across the city on a bicycle than using their car. But you're right that this continues to be kind of a minority phenomenon, in the sense that obviously not everyone in Paris lives in the city center, not everybody in Paris works in the city center. So what you have are a lot of people that by the fundamental nature of capitalism and the fundamental nature of work, they may work in one part of the city that not necessarily matches where they live. And that means that either they depend on public transport or they depend on the private car. And there, you know, where the rubber meets the road with this model and with the phasing out of cars is whether public authorities can supplement those needs with public transport. Mm-hmm. So if you're a Parisian who lives in a suburb and knows that they're going to spend an hour on an RER train to make it to work, whereas if they take their car, it may be 20 minutes of traffic, but 20 minutes, then they may opt for the 20 minutes so that they can stay in bed a little while longer.
Okay. If we take, though, like you mentioned there, if they're to get from, say, from one arrondissement, as they mm-hmm. call them in Paris, to another, you could certainly see like a different vibe in different parts of the city. And that's not just Paris. That's lots of cities, including the ones that we live in here in Ireland. And I do want to ask you about this, because there are some parts of cities that are run down. So how does this type of planning affect the distribution of services across the city? Like, how does it affect the equity of the people who live there?
So it's certainly something that's come up in Paris, because you're absolutely right that the 15-minute city plan was first executed in what we would call relatively prosperous neighborhoods. And, you know, it's very easy to make Le Marais or the area around the Pantheon a success story when it was already beautiful and you're just making it more beautiful. The argument that we hear from city authorities that are implementing it more widely is that in truth, it's actually almost a social justice urbanism scheme, because you are bringing services that were lacking to the poorer districts. So, for example, in Rome, where they have a councilman who's specifically in charge of it, his focus is not on implementing the 15-minute city, you know, around the Trevi Fountain, but rather in all of these little post-war suburbs that emerged very quickly when the city was expanding and taking in a lot of refugees from right after World War II. And these are places where they don't have sidewalks, they don't have a hospital, they lack schools, they may be the only place where you can do any sort of acquisition of food is a little coffee shop, but they don't actually have a market. So what the city tries to do is incentivize getting those businesses in there. And when they drop into these neighborhoods and they examine them and analyze them in accordance with the 15-minute city vision, essentially what they're doing is identifying what's lacking and trying to then find ways to either get private businesses to move in or to get public services moved in. And that's something that's really helping in these areas.
Okay, and we focused a lot on the positives here. And it's incumbent on me, of course, to look at this from some of the challenges that have come up with the thinking as well as the reaction to it. First of all, before I move on to that, I just want to talk about what 15 minutes is. Because if I walk for 15 minutes, I cover an awful lot less ground than if I get on an underground, let's say the RER in Paris, yeah, for example. So I'm going to go to Australia for a moment. If I was to look there, Melbourne's 20-minute neighbourhood strategy also ties in with the larger plan for the city, like the frequent transit linking local centres into a 30-minute region. Or here in Dublin even, I can use my Leap card on the Lewis, which is the tram, and on the bus, or there's the Dublin bike scheme here, which I use all the time to get on a bike to get around. So how does a 15-minute concept link in with cities where, like, there's an awful lot beyond the 15-minute radius?
Absolutely. So it is one of the criticisms that has always been leveled against the scheme. This idea of, you know, is this actually regressing to how European cities used to be before, where people would just stick in their specific neighborhoods and not really relate to people in other parts of the city? And that's not really the spirit behind it. You know, when I've spoken with Carlos Moreno, with this academic that I mentioned who came up with the plan, he's always said that what worries him is that people keep looking at this in a very strict focus, whereas he says, listen, guys, this is just an urban development scheme, but the idea isn't that you will be exclusively locked into your neighborhood. Rather, that the goal here is to ensure that every neighborhood is able to provide basics that right now, living in any European city, we know that some neighborhoods have better and more services than others. So again, the idea is to spread them out, but that doesn't mean that you would perpetually, you know, be trapped in your particular corner of the city. And certainly, you should be able to have the options to get out. The idea is for you not to have the necessity to have to go out every time you want to, you know, buy a certain product. Or, for example, if you want to access a theater, because part of this is also supposed to take into account access to culture. So the idea is, let's not have all the interesting theaters concentrated in the city centre, let's make sure that other neighbourhoods have them so that people have options.
Okay. But there can't be, you know, smoke without fire either. And I do want to interrogate this because I think, you know, we often, in this conversation, people often dismiss it as, oh, you know, it's a conspiracy theory and so on. But I just want to not let that be a smokescreen for the conversation either, because some people were calling this idea a climate lockdown. And certainly in a city like Edmonton in Canada, the government there needed to clarify that there was still freedom of movement. So has the conversation evolved past that backlash now? Or where do we stand culture-wise with this thinking?
It's funny. We saw this spark up around 2023, and we also saw this happen in Oxford and I think around Cambridge too in the UK. So it was a really interesting phenomenon because it was also based on a fallacy. A lot of people seem to be confusing the 15-minute city model with low emission zones.
Yeah, but there was also some politicians in the UK really helping that confusion to
absolutely, fester. Absolutely. And so the 15-minute city scheme has never been, you know, there has never been any talk of setting up barriers. That's absolutely not a thing. And yet there was this idea that, yeah, that they would try to lock you in your 15-minute city and you wouldn't be able to cross over. It's simply a conspiracy theory that certainly when you go to these places, you realize immediately it's just not real. But unfortunately, you are absolutely right that this is one of those points that advocates of this approach to the city have had to combat. And I think one of the most useful things that the public can take into account when they look at this is that in reality, we're talking about this like a very new concept, and sure, the name is relatively new. It's only been around for about 10 years, but really we're reinventing the wheel here. All that they're saying is let's just have neighborhoods where you can have access to basic services nearby.
And the other thing I don't want to conflate here is every city that I have named out are big ones. Dublin is probably the smallest of the list I've given you. Is this idea applicable to urban centers that aren't cities, like towns or like neighborhoods, like you say?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, when you talk to the experts, they would probably, you know, when they list like what is their model of the 15-minute city, a lot of times what they end up talking about are smaller provincial cities or towns. So, for example, one of the leading examples that I hear cited a lot is Utrecht in the Netherlands.
Yes, a beautiful place. Oh,
delightful. It's extremely charming, but we're not talking about a metropolis here. No. We're talking about a small university city.
That has the most gorgeous canal and a whole community built up around it. Before we go off anywhere else around the world, I'm going to have to stop there. Aitor Fernandez Morales from Politico, who joins me from Brussels. Thanks so much indeed for giving us a real geographical, a social and a political insight into the 15-minute city.
It's a great pleasure.
Thank you. Now, to give you the answers to my two economic trivia questions, what is the most sustainable building in Dublin? It is now A&L Goodbody's building on the North Quay. And the answer to the second question is 33% of Ireland's total electricity in 2024 was generated by wind energy. So that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes Cullerton. I hope you enjoyed the show and possibly even learned something about economics and how it affects our world. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast first thing on Friday mornings on the News Talk app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. It's also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy, and on research this week was Stephen Daunt and Simon Keane. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thanks so much for listening and enjoy the rest of your day. And I look forward to chatting to you again next week.